Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal well-being and everything that's going on in our world, everything that's going on in our communities, in our society, and in our ecosystem. We talk each week with different thought leaders, experts, authors, and advocates about all the different things that are going on and how they affect us in our world. On today's show, I'm delighted to have joining me Danny Goldberg. He is a longtime music industry uber professional, and he's recently written a wonderful book called In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967 and the Hippie Idea. This is published by Akashic Books. And just to give you an idea of Danny's background, he's managed numerous groups. He's been a recording company president and has been in the music business since the late 1960s, the epoch that he writes about. His current company, Gold Village Entertainment, he formed about a decade ago and continues to do artistic management. His clients have included Nirvana, Hole, Sonic Youth, Bonnie Raitt, the Allman Brothers, and many, many more. Also, he served as chairman and CEO of the Mercury Records Group. As distinguished as is his professional background in the music industry, Danny's also a keen social and cultural observer, and in his own way, politically active, even though that's not his main career. He certainly has that outlook and insight, as we'll discuss later in the show. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Danny Goldberg.
Thank you.
So, you know, in the book, you basically single out a single year, 1967, as kind of a benchmark year for the time of the hippies, for music, for the whole 1960s cultural event and uprising of the boomer generation. And you yourself were both a witness, a participant, and, you know, just a young kid who got entrained into it at the time and was drawn into it and eventually got professionally involved, but that came much later. One of the things that really kind of struck me about the book is the fact that the mood of you know, of rebellion, of uprising, of change and transformation had a more lighthearted, you know, kind of feeling about it. And it was kind of, you know, sort of fun and joyful and pranksterish and humorous. I mean, in comparison with, you know, the kind of uprisings that are happening now, which are far more serious, I would love to hear your view about how that epoch in that earlier time, in that earlier generation, served as a precursor to some of what we're looking at now, and what is different about the two times.
Okay, well, it's a broad subject. Let me just first say the idea of focusing on 1967 was a little bit arbitrary. But it of course, this year, 2017, has all these different 50th anniversaries of things that happened that year, which is a wide-ranging group of things, some of which were idealistic and lighthearted, some of which were quite dark. Certainly, the hippie culture kind of hit the mass pop screen that year. It had been developing for several years, and it was, you know, the heir of earlier bohemian movements, the beatniks, the transcendentalists, and many others. But it collided with the baby boom generation and kind of a moment when the media, you know, wanted to focus on that generation to, you know, not for altruistic reasons, but to please advertisers at the same time that technology permitted new media, such as, you know, what was then called underground FM radio and some of the underground papers. So it became kind of a mass consciousness. And there was, in the hippie side of it, a anti-materialism, a utopianism. There's no question that the easy availability of psychedelics in the first year after LSD was made illegal, and therefore easier to get, as happens, you know, made a lot of people get into, at least temporarily, sort of a spiritual view of who they were. And it was also a year when the Beatles, who were the most famous people in the world, started talking about meditation. At the same time, it was a very intense year during the Vietnam War. 20 million young men were subject to the draft. 56,000 Americans would eventually be killed, millions of Asians. It was a year when race relations were having a particularly agonizing passage. Obviously, slavery is one of the original sins of America, Jim Crow. For the next 100 years after the Civil War, the Civil Rights Movement made some real progress in the late 50s and early 60s. But by 67, the frustration of still patterns of discrimination that affected job opportunities, housing opportunities, policing, and so many other things boiled over, and there were the worst urban race riots, or some called rebellions, you know, since the Civil War, far worse than anything we've seen since. So there was a lot of darkness then, but there was a balance. And that's why I called the book In Search of the Lost Chord, because to me there was a balance of different energies that collectively, to me as a teenager who was graduated from high school that year, was just inspired by the idea that this combination of energies could imply a better future. So by the following year, it got darker. Not that all the light went away. These things don't happen overnight one way or the other, but obviously the assassinations of Dr. King and Robert Kennedy were devastating blows to the balance of American culture and politics. And the publicity that the counterculture got damaged it an enormous amount. It became commercialized, trivialized, it attracted predators, and so on. And So I focused on 67, but you know, the 60s writ large, you know, a lot of people think it kind of started when John Kennedy got assassinated in 63 and ended with Nixon resigning, you know, in the middle of the 70s. There's no one moment. In terms of the comparison to today, I think it's important, first of all, that people who are overwhelmed with fear, anxiety, sometimes bordering on despair, not forget how difficult it was in the past. It was very, very difficult to oppose the war in Vietnam, and many people went to jail and got beaten up and had their careers damaged because of it. It was very difficult to deal with patterns of segregation. The FBI at that time was vicious. Whatever problems we've had with the FBI in the last few years, and I think, you know, obviously there were problems in the last election. I think J. Edgar Hoover was a far worse and more dangerous character than anything we've seen at the FBI since. And so the people that were trying to shine some light were not doing it just walking down a path of rose petals. They were taking real risks, and there were dark forces that they were contending with. And I think that, you know, there were some things that are driven by the 24-hour news cycle or by technology or by fashions of the moment. And obviously, it's an incredibly different time. There was no internet then. There was, you know, no hybrid cars. The sense of the peril to the environment was not as great. The environmental movement was just sort of being birthed in many quarters. But some of the basic issues are similar. The tendency of people on the left, meaning anyone sort of, you know, from a Democrat to a radical, the infighting was sabotaged a lot of progress at that time. I still worry about that today. And I recently wrote about it. And the importance of young people is similar. I think that the protest against the war in Vietnam was empowered by the passion of a young generation who questioned the so-called experts and who didn't know what they didn't know and had a certain courage that's harder to have when you get older. And I think that today I look to the young generation to be the cutting edge of hope, because I think that they're very progressive politically. I think the response Bernie Sanders got should be very encouraging. And I think that they understand this new technology a lot better than my generation does, and there are a lot of them. It's the biggest generation in history. So I think those are some similarities, and of course there are many differences.
I agree with you about the young generation, and in fact, I do feel also, as much as this is a very difficult time for the environment and for other, you know, for democracy, this large generation of aware and many of them committed and really bright kids coming in does give hope. And actually, there have been many times when I've looked at them and thought, you know, as a member of the 60s generation myself, and, you know, as time has progressed, you're always looking for that next generation that kind of picks up the banner again in a certain sense. And we've had many, you know, sort of many of the intervening generations have done all the stuff that many people from the 60s generation were forced to do, you know, which is kind of get on the professional treadmill, get involved in, American business and life and stuff like that. And, you know, some of them have done it without a backward glance, where the 60s generation was much more about, taking a broader look at where that was taking us, taking time out to kind of consider what aspects of it maybe weren't working. I mean, the extent to which we kind of went back into it varies, I suppose, by individuals. But there aren't a lot of people who are, you know, enduring hippies all the way from 1967 to the present moment, although there are some. So this current generation really almost has seemed like the generation that's going to pick up the banner, but maybe do it differently, because we're in a different time, and there may be, and with different tools, as you point out, and also different needs and potentialities, and a different sense. I think it may be a different sense of urgency, perhaps, because, you know, there, like, for example, one thing that struck me was in your book, you know, you were describing how in San Francisco, people who were members of the broader community would go to get leftover food and, you know, bring it and cook it for others to eat. I think you were saying that a group called the Diggers did that. They found out that if they went with their long hair and their beards and everything, they were turned away. But if they sent a lovely, you know, young mom in with a kid to collect the food, they did much better. And this food was then distributed to poorer communities, black communities and others who would not have been given the food. So it was kind of like, I was really struck by that because it was like a creative cultural, an impulse to help, to see beyond, one's own needs, to help on, an intercommunity level. It's almost like a foreshadowing of a lot of the intersectionalism that's being asked for and called for today. And yet, obviously, it was just kind of an impulse of this group. They did it with some commitment. It was never systematized in any way. So, you know, it strikes me there could be many such moments where, the impulse to care for, to relate across sectors and lines, to look at what's going on with everyone rather than just kind of take care of one's own castle kind of thing, was there in that time. And there must be, I'm sure there must be many anecdotes and different situations like that in your research you've come across, that really are important inspirations from our history, but that, people who didn't live at the time or weren't in maybe some of the spaces you were may not be aware of. Were there others like that? I mean, it seems like there was a kind of innocence and enthusiasm to care in some kind of way that was part of that, with the love, the peace, love message.
Well, I think, first of all, to just frame kind of the book, and then I'll try to respond to what you were saying. I was not really much of a participant in the things I wrote about. I was 16 and 17 years old. I was a kid. I was sort of mesmerized by it, though, and inspired by it. And what I tried to do in the book was not tell too much about myself, because I don't think I was all that interesting as a teenager, although a few times I try to frame certain things based on what I and some friends in high school were getting turned on by, because I just thought it would kind of give a little personal flavor to it. But it's really a history of things I missed, of things I wasn't old enough to be part of, and which to me left a legacy that was inspiring. And that's the perspective and the place from which I described it. The group, the Diggers, to me was a very interesting group of people. The best known of them were the late Emmett Grogan, who died, you know, some time ago, and Peter Coyote, who's still alive and thriving as an actor and has written, they both wrote memoirs that I think are well worth reading for anybody who wants to understand kind of some of the most idealistic and radical figures of the late 60s, particularly of the Haight-Ashbury culture. They were a very small group, the Diggers. I think, as far as I can tell, not more than a dozen. They came out of experimental theater and, you know, did a lot of what today would be called performance art on the streets. And they did, though, as part of their ethos, believe in things being free. I don't think it's so easy to implement that on a mass scale. And, but the example that they set by the free food that you just described, they would, you know, make several hundred meals available in the community a week. And they experimented with a free store and other things like that, sort of set a moral bar and a reality check for people that I think was important in terms of the mix of issues. I think I don't see any way that it's possible for the whole society to work like that in the worlds that I've seen. But the idea of reminding people that we have kind of a mutual, that we're part of a human family and that we should care about each other and not just ignore each other and live in our silos, I think is extremely important, especially for those of us that like to meditate and get into a spiritual place. The flip side of that to me is compassion and brotherhood. I think those are ideas that were not unique to the 60s. They're part of almost every spiritual tradition. But the thing about the 60s was that those ideas kind of collided and influenced mass culture and pop culture in a time that was no less materialistic than today's society. And that was kind of the anomaly of the 60s to me, was that these bohemian idealistic ideas became part of the pop conversation. I don't have a catalog of altruism. There's just thousands of people doing things for other people around the world and in history. But I think that it's admirable, and it's something that everybody should try to aspire to, depending on what their capability is and their other obligations and so on. Just the idea that we have some that we're connected, that we're not just, like you said, isolated into our own clans and tribes, but that we're connected to humanity and should have some concern for other human beings, even those that don't dress like us or speak the same language or necessarily share the same political beliefs.
And I mean, if the 60s generation and that hippie idea that you describe in the book kind of, you know, was opening a broader popular door on that, do you feel that it's progressed? Or, you know, right now there has been a progression. I think the Bernie Sanders campaign represented a progression, and now, of course, we're in a devolution, at least, you know, for some time, given the values in the current administration. You know, some say, one of the things that you say in your Nation article is that we should banish the term neoliberal. The term is used to describe, like segments of the population that have liberal social values while having, more materialist or more capitalist economic values. And the sort of, the kind of disjunction between the two, where, you know, both are held together, and yet it isn't maybe, you know, it may work as a fit for a certain segment of the society, but it may not really work that well for other segments of society. I see that as kind of, a big reason why we have, you know, we're in the current boat with Trump and the, you know, his corporate cronies, you know, basically taking down all regulations, taking down government, putting in, you know, very harsh agendas, tearing down healthcare, all of that. You know, it's a decline. It's an acceleration of materialist values, and a decline in caring and sharing values, at least at this particular moment as we're speaking. And some trace that to, you know, the attempt to kind of hold liberal values on, you know, a certain side in terms of tolerance for different kinds of populations, but still, you know, running the capitalist engine in a way that isn't necessarily beneficial for, you know, all segments of society. So in your recent Nation article, you basically, which is just this, you know, just this very week, and I had it up on my page, and people have been commenting and having a whole discussion about that. It's called "The Circular Firing Squad Isn't Amusing Anymore." You've said that you would recommend banishing the term neoliberalism, which kind of describes that split. Is it because you don't really feel there is a split, or do you feel the term is divisive and non-constructive in some kind of way? I'd like to, you know, hear, you know, what you think about that.
Yeah, it's the word itself that I was talking about, and let me just try to, again, you said a lot of different things, so let me try to comment on a bunch of them. First of all, I certainly recognize that there's a range of opinion among people that aren't Republicans, and that there is a category. I prefer, if I want to describe the more the kind of the people with the positions that you were mentioning that are kind of pro-gay rights and free speech and pro-choice, but who are conservative on economic issues. I prefer the phrase corporate Democrats. If you have to give a label to it, because the word neoliberal to me has become just an epithet. It just dehumanizes people and lumps a lot of different people together in a way that's, to me, not intellectually or morally fair. I also have complicated feelings about the word liberal. And, you know, my generation that was so horrified by the Vietnam War, were horrified by what we called Cold War liberals, people that were for the war in Vietnam but said they were for the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act and other things like that. And, one of my favorite songs as a teenager was Phil Oakes's Love Me, I'm a Liberal, which mocked Cold War liberalism. And one of the speeches that most inspired me was a speech that the former head of SDS, Carl Oglesby, gave at a March on Washington 65 that I went to when I was in high school, where he talked about how the people that pursued the Vietnam had broken his liberal heart, and and so on. So the word was tarnished terribly by the Vietnam War. Then you get to the 80s, where Reagan just accused anybody that didn't agree with conservatives of being a liberal, kind of from the right. And, people then chose different words. In the 60s, people liked the word radical, but then that word lost some of its legitimacy for some of us when people that were in favor of violence were using that word. And then the kind of feel-good word progressive came along. And I myself usually call myself a progressive because it doesn't have the baggage. But I think of my parents and who were very much against the war in Vietnam and who were, supported Henry Wallace instead of Harry Truman in 1948 because they felt that Truman had betrayed the idealism of Roosevelt's New Deal. I think of George McGovern, who wrote a beautiful book about liberal ideas and things. And, you know, McGovern, to me, was progressive in every sense of the world. He couldn't be more different from corporate Democrats. He was a democratic socialist by another name. He was to me one of the great moral figures, and he loved that word liberal because it reminded him of his younger years and pre-Vietnam and the kind of compassion and view of a society that would create a social security program and so on and so forth. So you know, I just don't like needlessly excluding people from group efforts to try to make the world better, and it seems to me that that word has become a conversation stopper. It just, you're a neoliberal means you're evil, you're not worth talking to, you're not moral, you're selfish, and I don't think that that's a constructive way to engage people that we disagree with. That doesn't mean that I don't recognize the distinctions between people that say they're Democrat. I mean, I myself have frequently been very critical of, you know, Democrats who are not for economic justice, and I continue to be, and I will be. I voted for and publicly supported Bernie Sanders in the primaries, and I very much admire him today. I probably share the policy goals of a lot of the people that are mad at me for questioning the use of that word neoliberal. My problem with it is it doesn't, to me, make things better. It creates tribal divisions among a group of people that have to find a way of working together, even if we continue to disagree with each other. I disagreed with an enormous amount of things that Hillary Clinton stood for as Secretary of State and that Bill Clinton did as president. But I think, you know, I made a choice in 2016 that there was one of two people who were going to be president, and I would have preferred that she was president instead of Donald Trump, and nothing that's happened since the election has made me change that particular opinion. I don't understand why one can't make those kind of distinctions and at the same time make the distinction between different kinds of Democrats. And the Democrats that I identify with are people like Maxine Waters, Elizabeth Warren, my Congressman Jerry Nadler, the progressive wing, you know, I just I feel that there's a level of tribalism on the left, and you know, everybody from the middle of the road Democrats to, you know, Occupy Wall Street, you know, that doesn't make the world a better place. That there has to be a way of having disagreements and standing up for our principles. And that includes criticizing Democrats and criticizing, people that you don't agree with without dehumanizing them to the extent that it forecloses the possibility of working together and making things better. Because at the end of the day, what matters is not who writes the most clever Facebook post or who writes the best Nation article or who gets the biggest laugh at a party or who gets the biggest reaction at a speech at a rally. What matters is, are the lives of more people made better or made worse? What actually happens on the ground? Are more people being able to get a decent education or not? Are more people able to get decent health care or not? Is there progress made on the environment or not? And there has to be some connectivity between the tactics and the style with which we do these things and some sort of a vision of how things could actually get better. And to revert back to the 60s, you know, one of my favorite songs about all of this was John Lennon's song, Revolution. And Lennon certainly was courageous. He was against the war in Vietnam. He risked deportation. You know, he also made plenty of money as being one of the Beatles. And to me, if you're one of the Beatles, you probably deserve to make a lot of money. But I think he to me was a interesting artist, one of the great artists that rock and roll ever produced. And you know, he writes that song, Revolution, and he spent a lot of time with American political radicals such as Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, made one all-political record with Elephant's Memory, wrote the peace anthem, Give Peace a Chance. You know, in Revolution, he said, you know, you say you want a revolution, we'd all love to see the plan. What, you know, there has to be some aspirational plan. How does this get us where we want to go? How do we actually change things for the better? How do we convince enough people that we hit a critical enough mass that it can overcome the corrupt influences of materialism, whether it's democratic materialism, republican materialism, or libertarian materialism, or nihilistic materialism. How do we actually do it? And I worry that there's a level of what Freud called the narcissism of small difference, the need to act like your own particular group of friends is morally superior to all others. That doesn't feel like idealism to me. It doesn't feel like it's making the world a better place. That doesn't mean, though, that we should refrain from disagreeing with people when we think they're wrong. And I have many criticisms of Presidents Clinton and Obama, many disappointments with both of them, and at the same time, I preferred them to the people they ran against. I don't know why one can't hold both of those positions and be a good person.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one can and be a good person. I think I totally get exactly where you're coming from. And, you know, I also think language is important. And, you know, I mean, this term corporate Democrat or whatever, you know, if neoliberal is in effect, what you're saying is it's kind of smudging, you know, not in a good way, but it's besmirching, you know, something that has been good and carried.
I totally get that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's no exact definition of it. It feels a lot like... the word liberal is in there, and it feels a lot like saying anyone who's a liberal is a sellout and inherently corrupt. And I don't think that's true of Maxine Waters or Elizabeth Warren or George McGovern or people like that. And I don't think they espoused any of the views that people associate with neoliberals. But I just think the phrase it's become one of those phrases to me that stops communication instead of enhancing it. And I feel the same way about people who are Clinton supporters who refer to, you know, Bernie bros, as if because I voted for Bernie Sanders, I'm in favor of some sexist remark that some idiot made at a rally when there were, you know, 15 million or however many million voted for Bernie. You know, I'm against these epithets coming from any point of view because they foreclose communication. And I don't see how we make things better without more communication instead of less. So it is a feel-good quality, the feeling self-righteous and me and my friends are the best people and everyone else sucks. And, you know, that's fine privately to get you through the day. But in the public space where we're trying to actually come up with an alternative philosophy to nihilistic materialism, which is currently controlling most of the government, we need to do better than that.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I totally hear that. I agree with you. And, you know, I think it's very, very important. We're kind of at risk of becoming a Tower of Babel, where it's, you know, it's not only my group, but it's my particular signature issues, so that we don't necessarily look at what are the, you know, the biggest, highest priorities for intervention to kind of shift the situation. Not that, you know, we want to leave any issue out necessarily, but, you know, which ones are most instrumental and need to lead in order, you know, in a strategic way so that we get from A to B to C. And one of the things that occurs to me as you speak is that because we do have this two-party system, it's kind of, you know, it boils down into this divisive kind of horse race, and that's also how this is portrayed on, you know, television news and all of that, all of the election stuff. It's always a, you know, blue versus red. It's always a horse race. That's inherently very divisive. There's, you know, in other European countries, it's not just two parties facing off like ruthless competitors. You know, there are different, there's place for more groups to lead on certain issues and, you know, to create more dialogue and to create coalitions. I mean, I would love it if we had a system like that. And I think inherently, you know, the two-party, you know, being kind of locked into that is a big limitation in terms of how we navigate from this moment on. I mean, are there any issues that you see as priority issues or that even going back to, you know, 1967 have kind of traveled, you know, from that time to this that you think could have that potential for, you know, uniting larger segments of people or for really making a change? I mean, I mean, I'll just say that having been a health journalist reporting on health, food, and the environment for, you know, 25 years, I am really dismayed about the fact that as the Republicans, you know, are basically stripping down health insurance, which is like writing a death sentence to people, that we don't have a way to go towards single payer, which is what so many people want. I mean, would the right signature issue be a way of building goodwill? Between, you know, I would kind of raise hands on that one myself, but you may have other ones that you identify, like how, and I do agree with you about communication, too. If we start out fundamentally slamming the door, we may not get there. But what would you see as priorities for creating less division and bringing people together in a way that if we got this thing done, it would signify something, and the next thing would be, it would be easier to move in a different direction?
Well, I think, just firstly, I agree with you. I think single payer is both morally completely right and may be ripe for a mass movement in a way that for whatever reasons it didn't seem to have been before. I just noticed today Al Gore came out for single payer. Now, that's kind of interesting. He's not going to run for president again. He's not a current leader in the Senate or the Congress. But, you know, he's a national figure. He's got to be one of the top 10 national Democrats alive, you know. And, you know, he's someone that was part of the Clinton administration. And I think that's an interesting positive development that he's sort of on the side with Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. I think it signals a potential for a broadening of it. And it also is tuning into something that obviously an enormous variety of people in all states and of all political backgrounds care deeply about, because everybody has to deal with health. So it just affects everybody. And there's been this sort of temporarily, at least, encouraging public response that seemed to have put a roadblock into a backwards step on this. Obamacare was far from ideal. I've always been for single payer. You know, I'm a big fan of Michael Moore's movie Sicko, which anticipated some of these healthcare debates, and which I think is not always get the credit it deserves in terms of how it framed a lot of those issues, and worth rewatching for anybody that wants to just get kind of a populist refresher course on how to talk about some of these things. So I believe you got to go. If you're going to have massive change, there are mysterious currents that you have to kind of ride a wave of. I mean, Dr. King was a genius, probably the greatest, you know, one of the greatest communicators in American history and the greatest leaders in American history, both morally and tactically. But he also emerged at a moment in time that was pregnant for what he did, because it was after World War II. It was, you know, Jackie Robinson and integrated baseball. You know, Brown versus Board of Education decision signals that the Supreme Court's going to be more progressive, and so you know, he's certainly the hero of my book. There were dozens and dozens of people I write about that were on the public stage in '67, many of whom I admire, ranging from, you know, Richard Alpert to Allen Ginsberg to the Beatles, but to Muhammad Ali, you know, and dozens of others. But Dr. King is absolutely, to me, my North Star morally as an American leader. But even with Dr. King, was aware that you have to kind of find these invisible waves to really to connect with the mass public that actually implements and executes change. And I agree with you. I think single payer's moment may be at hand, and if one could pull it off, it's such a big deal in terms of how it would affect people's lives, the improvement it would make in the economy. We've got all these examples of other countries who do this much better than us. So I'm encouraged. I you know, if I had to pick one today, this minute, while we're having this conversation, I would agree with you. I think that's the moment may be at hand for that. And I think it's going to be very, very hard for anyone to be get the Democratic nomination for president if they don't support single payer next time, because I think that's where the at least enough of the public is going. And that's a big deal, because that has all sorts of implications for other kinds of policies. So I'm with you on that one.
I actually reviewed Sicko for the Huffington Post when I was their first health reporter back in the day. So I, you know, and that has been an inspiration. I mean, I come also from the proactive health community where we, you know, eat right and do all these great things to prevent, you know, or try to limit risk for illness and stuff like that. And, you know, there's always the hope that we, you know, people who are able to do that, assiduous enough, affluent enough, or whatever else, getting the right consultations enough, will be able to kind of lessen their own health impacts and avoid, you know, the medical system. But we can't make that choice on behalf of, you know, the whole population of people that really need that and rely on that and that are, you know, not eating an optimal diet, who have different, you know, stressors in their lives that make life difficult. I mean, if we don't have a safety net for people, you know, then even something like health, which is a positive to seek, becomes like a competitive rat race, you know, like that one is like running to stay up ahead of, you know, the curve on that. And I think it has, actually, I think that everyone's health affects everyone. And, you know, it has and running to outpace, you know, a society with increasing ailments and higher costs for illness and everything is like not the way, you know, not the way we have to go. I could see
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it gets into a side of people's minds and personalities that's not necessarily behind the bunkers of whatever political identity they decided they were 10 or 20 years ago. It gets right into their lives in a way that makes this stuff real. And I think that the logic for you know, for the vast majority of people is very powerful. So I'm with you on that. I've been thinking along the same lines.
It also, you know, and I think about this a lot because of being in that field and everything. It represents a shift in values. It's really getting to core values. You know, health, life, living beings, living systems, these are really core values. They are, you know, the material values that we, you know, are kind of like logistical or structural engines that are man-created, that we set up, that are ideally, you know, to support core values and make things run better. But if, in fact, they are undermining core values like health and life, you know, then I think it really it gets us to the bottom line of what our values are, and beyond, you know, some of this you know, siloization or indoctrination or, you know, or something that we really palpably do all have in common and share. So anyway, we're you know, and I think we need a kind of currency change. I think that it would be helpful for more people, you know, maybe to go back to the 60s, you know, to the hippie idea, you know, that materialism, you know, it has its own kind of problems, and while, you know, it should be there structurally to support us, it shouldn't be imprisoning us, overwhelming us, putting life and life resources at risk. I mean, you know, that's throwing the baby out, you know, to kind of hold on to something.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the word hippie is another one of those words that's just freighted with enormous baggage because, as I said earlier, it was very quickly co-opted by the media, and there were, you know, people selling love burgers and, you know, diners in Haight-Ashbury, and the Hollywood sitcoms would sort of have parodies of hippies that came across like morons. And, you know, and then there were people that moved to these neighborhoods and grew their hair long and became drug addicts or predators. And, you know, the external symbols that, you know, were drained of meaning almost immediately. But the essence of it to me had nothing to do with those symbols, nor with the word hippie. It had to do with defining ourselves as souls and not just in terms of our roles in the world, not just defining ourselves in terms of how much money we make or our position. Now, that's not a new concept. That's inherent in Christianity and Judaism and Islam. in Buddhism and in all the great spiritual traditions. But a lot of people in the modern world, have a problem with organized religion. They have bad experiences as children. They feel too many rules, or it's bossy, or some of them have sexually repressive rules that just seem immoral and contradictory of being a good person. And then you've got sort of traditional religion in its pure sense, which just is very inspiring for some people, but has not proved to be a mass thing in this era. And then you've got materialism, which is the dominant ideology, as far as I can tell, of the West and of America, which is a shallow value system. And that doesn't mean one can't appreciate material possessions. I mean, I made my living in the music business. I much preferred it when we had hits instead of flops. I always wanted to get paid as much as I could without within the bounds of ethics, and I still do. And I don't begrudge Bob Dylan from making money from his songs. No one else can write songs like that, and people are paying for him, and he should get most of the money. But that doesn't mean that one becomes so intoxicated and addicted to those external things that you forget about the actual meaning of life. To me, the contribution of the 60s was to create another kind of highway of consciousness that people could go down other than Orthodox religions, which alienated too many people, or pure materialism, which can temporarily be satisfying, but very temporarily, and is not ultimately a long-term thing. And so that, to me, is what I was inspired by. I think that fragmented, some religions were revived and influenced by it. Some people found places within themselves. Some people became burned out and alienated. But to me, materialism as an ideology is a dead-end street, whether it's, Soviet-style communism or whether it's Ayn Rand-style capitalism. That doesn't mean one doesn't deal rationally with material goods. It just means that it's not God.
I mean, in effect, I think that's, that makes complete sense. And in effect, the current president is almost like a cartoon, of the calf of gold or something like that.
I would say that ideology that what he represents is certainly, even prior to this, what got in there, the TV show he had, The Art of the Deal, the triumphalism of the logo Trump, I think that's right. And I think to some people who, obviously it just made them feel empowered. Part of it was a lot of people felt left out of the liberal world, not just the neoliberal world, but the whole the party that we all had just didn't include everybody. I blame some of the 60s culture for that. We were so concerned with our own hipness that we didn't always have compassion and respect for people that were in different paths. And that kind of polarization is part of what gave rise to the Trump phenomenon. But look, I also feel it's important to have some perspective on the human race and not feel that our particular year of life, our particular generation, is the whole human story. This drama has been going on for thousands of years. There's been steps forward and steps backward. I still think it's better that women can vote and that there's not legal slavery in America, neither of which were the case when the country started. You talked about our electoral system. It's an 18th century system. It's ridiculous why Wyoming, gets the same number of senators as California or New York. There's no moral justification for that. All those old arrangements had to do with the self-interest of people in the 1700s, some of whom were slave owners. And we're sort of stuck with it for the moment because it's terrifying to think what a new constitution would be, given the power of people like the, billionaires and all that sort of a thing. But I think that somehow human beings have overcome terrible obstacles in the past. I think back on the labor movement, and I don't even understand how labor unions ever got established against the entrenched power of companies often backed by the government. I don't understand how women ever got the vote, given the fact that men had to make the decisions, you know, or how slavery was ever ended. I'm reading Sid Blumenthal's second volume of his Life of Lincoln now, Wrestling with His Angel. I mean, it's unbelievable how in the 1850s, just a few years before Lincoln was elected, how many people in northern states were still for slavery, how marginalized abolitionists were, you know, something that's a moral no-brainer to us today, you know, just 150 years ago. So, you know, somehow human beings do overcome darkness in the past, and I think we have to just take inspiration from them, but not expect it to happen in 24 hours or necessarily the next few months. Or we just have to every day do the best we can and remember that people have been through much worse times than what we're going through.
If it weren't for, you know, the climate, I mean, that's the thing that kind of puts the, you know, the ticking clock and makes it a lot more dramatic than it has been otherwise. I mean, and especially, and it's like, obviously, currently we're in the, you know, worst case scenario. I mean, one of the wins that, you know, I've been part of is banning fracking in New York State, you know, local battle, and I'm, you know, connected to people all throughout the country who are working on various environmental fronts, and it's actually very inspiring to get involved and participate, which I regularly, you know, kind of hawk on this show and everything. But, you know, we do have a, you know, there is an acceleration because of the fact that we have now moved to a state where we're, you know, basically undermining the global habitat if we continue in our ways and stuff like that. So that does provide some urgency. But I also do, I agree with you about the younger generation and the hope. And I think also, I mean, I didn't vote for Trump. I never counseled that anyone should vote for him. But, you know, it certainly has drawn people's attention to, you know, the problem we have here if we just kind of continue on with this. So I think, you know, more people need to get more involved. I just want to say for a moment we're talking with Danny Goldberg, the author of In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967 and the Hippie Idea, a recent book published by Akashic Books. You know,
at some point has to look at the meaning of their life. They have to think about how they, you know, what they want to feel about their life when they transition to whatever happens after this incarnation. And, you know, historically, sometimes people with those kind of resources have been helps to things. You know, and there's the elites are not monolithic. There are disagreements among billionaires, and some of them are more compassionate and open-minded and evolved than others. And, you know, the ones that are should be encouraged, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly interesting, too.
And the fact that somebody does, and the converse of that, you know, and I think Naomi Klein wrote pretty intelligently about this in her book about the environment, is there are people that sort of do things that are for PR value but that aren't really sincere on the major issues, and it's fine to point that out too. You know, I mean, I just think that the main thing I feel is generalizations are usually the enemy of truth and of progress, and that you need to really deal with each situation fairly on its own pluses and minuses. And you know, but I don't think everybody who's wealthy is the same. We know for sure not. They don't all have the same politics. They don't all do the same things with their money. And to the extent that people use their money to try to help other people, that's a good thing. And to the extent that they do it just to look good but don't really help other people, that's kind of lame. And to the extent that they're just funding Donald Trump, that's horrible, you know. So you know, you've got these different categories, and within each one there's hundreds of different shades of gray. You know, we don't get perfect people. We get human beings, and we have to kind of have compassion for the dark parts of ourselves and try to get better and recognize that people are not perfect, but still we can encourage the good parts of them. Anyway, I've really appreciated being able to talk to you, I appreciate very much your interest in my book.
Well, thank you so much for being on Connect the Dots. You've been you know, reviewed in the New York Times, and you've been in Truthdig and The Nation, and, you know, I'm a Truthdig contributor and stuff like that. So you're really covering the territory. People, it's a great book, In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967, and The Hippie Idea, just recently out this past month. And, you know, please do get it. As you can see, there's a lot in it. If you're from the generation, I just also have to say, it's kind of almost like going back to a scrapbook of youth. I remembered the first Bein in New York, which you cover in the book, which I spent with Mike Bloomfield. You know,
I'm jealous
of an old.
Anyway, listen, I've got to go, but I thank you so
right.
much again.
Well, well, who, well.